Good morning and welcome. I heard a story once about a rancher who had gone to the city to take care of some business and woke up in his motel Sunday morning to see a lot of snow and nobody going anyplace, but there was a church across the street. So he went to the church and he was the only one there. But the minister said, well, he's here. The organist was here. So they played through the whole service, everything, all the hymns. And as the service ended, the minister said, well, nice that you could be here. Hope you enjoyed the service. Well, the man said, I'm a rancher. And when I take feed to the pasture and only one steer shows up, I just leave part of the food there. But we're going to leave the whole load here, no matter how many of us might be here. I have one announcement to make, and that is that we have made coffee. The editorial we, and it will be available in the kitchen following the service for anybody who wants to have some. I want to welcome you to our annual service dedicated to the remembrance of those who died this past year. I am Michael Oldfather, and it is my honor to be your host for the next 60 to 70 minutes. If you have arrived here with only vague notions about what to expect, our most succinct way to introduce ourselves is captured by our commitment to be a welcoming congregation. That phrase first came into use as a clear signal that we wish to include everyone without regard to sexual orientation. And it has been expanded to include guests and members, whatever their ethnicity, age, education, level of or political affiliation, gender, and just about any other way which might be a source for dividing us into competing camps. An example of this spirit might be as follows. In recent days, what did you say when somebody wished you a Merry Christmas? Here are possible responses. And I hope you have or had a Merry Christmas too. And season's greetings to you, my friend. Oh, I see that you are fascinated by the season's mix of pagan traditions and Christian mythology. No matter what you might have said, you are welcome here. I forgot to ask somebody to light the chalice, but maybe somebody will come and do that while I'm speaking about it. The chalice, which we light every Sunday, was designed by Hans Deutsch, an Austrian refugee. He had fled the Nazi tyranny in his homeland for safety in Paris, where as an artist, he drew many popular cartoons that featured very unflattering characterizations of Hitler. When Paris surrendered to the Germans, Deutsch left all his possessions behind and fled again, this time for the neutral country of Portugal. It was there that he made connections with the organization now known as the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, whose principal mission was helping Jews and Unitarians find passage to safety somewhere. His contribution to those efforts was to design a symbol which could be readily recognized for its bearer's commitment of helping others like him badly in need of sanctuary. While the flaming chalice's symbolism has grown from its early 1940s roots to encompass many different meanings, when we light it this morning, or look at a close resemblance of its initial form out in the narthex, perhaps we can remember Hans Deutsch's gift to us and the men and women of the UUSC who saved the lives of so many enemies of fascism in Europe during World War II. Our opening song, hymn is 346. What is that? I've got to lead it. Come sing a song with me.
Come sing a song with me. Come sing a song with me. Come sing a song with me, that I might know your mind. Then I'll bring you hope when hope.
Just a second. I'm going to change the key. There we go. Oh, that feels a lot better.
Come sing a song with me. Come sing a song with me. Come sing a song with me, that I might know your mind. Then I'll bring you hope when hope is hard to find. And I'll bring a song of love and a rose in the winter time. Come dream a dream with me. Come dream a dream with me. Come dream a dream with me, that I might know your mind. Then I'll bring you home when hope is hard to find. And I'll bring a song of love and a rose in the wind. Come walk in rain with me. Come walk in rain with me. Come walk in rain with me, that I might know your mind. Then I'll bring you home when hope is hard to find. And I'll bring a song of love and a rose in the winter time. Come share a rose with me. Come share a rose with me. Come share a rose with me, that I might know your mind. Then I'll bring you hope when hope is hard. I'll bring a song of love and a rose in the winter time.
The children could come up here, and we will have a little bit of time with them. And children of any age and who wants to come up, it will be easy. Come on up. And it's going to take a fair amount of help from the audiences, the big children in the audience, to carry this off. I know that when you get to your class after this, you will be talking about New Year's resolutions. Who knows what a New Year's resolution is? All right, tell us. Wow, you'll do something to make yourself better in the year. All right, and so I will lead this, but I'll ask people in the audience to give some examples of New Year's resolutions that they have made over the years. Now, I'll tell you one I made when I was in school, and too young. I made the New Year's resolution to quit smoking cigarettes. And on January the 15th, I smoked one. But that was the last one for almost 2 years. And in subsequent years, I made the same resolution. And it took more the years than I'd like to remember to finally keep it. And I have not smoked a cigarette since November 20th of 1963. They were just getting too expensive. And I didn't have any children, but I thought, I'm going to have children. And how can you tell children that smoking is a bad idea when you got a pack of Pall Malls in your pocket? And so that's why I finally did make it, but it took a long time. So out there are people who have made and possibly kept New Year's resolutions, and they're going to tell you about them and maybe how well they worked out. Gene
Severs. Last year I vowed to gain weight, and I broke that more months than not. So 20 pounds ago, I'm vowing to gain more weight.
You know that he's somewhat not somewhat serious.
I have one resolution, Ann Cowan. I have one resolution that I make every year, and that's to lose 10 pounds. It's probably the same 10 pounds every year. But this year, I have new resolutions. I have four closets full of clothes in my house, and by the end of this year, one of them is going to be empty, I swear. And one shelf is going to be free of books. It's now full of books.
All right. Got another one here.
We were asked to remember our New Year's resolutions, I'm Kathy Hedge, and when I was in third grade, I made this resolution, and I kept it ever since. And the resolution was to brush my teeth at least twice a day because I had an abscess tooth, and that thing hurt. And I said, I'm never going to let that happen again. And so I learned about dental health when I was a third grader. And I made other promises over the years how to get myself better each year when I was going from little kid to older person. And most of those are too embarrassing to tell you.
Sabrina Boker. Every year I usually make the resolution to eat healthier, and every year I usually end up eating donuts and such. But this year I'm going to make a resolution to write every day and practice piano every day, but hopefully I can keep those.
A couple back over there.
Jim Chanteau. I made a resolution several years ago, in fact, to get here on time each Sunday because we didn't start always at 10:45. We used to start at 11, and somehow I never got that straight in my mind. Well, today, of all days, I actually showed up on early, and of course, I'm no longer here. So I guess maybe that's the consequence of not living here anymore.
I'm Livia Olson, and every year I make a resolution to read a lot of books. And this year my number was 60, which seems really high, but I make it that high because I like to read a lot of children's books, including picture books. And so I'm at 58 today, so I have two more to get through by the end of today.
Well, congratulations.
One of the best books I read this year, and it was the only book that made me cry this year, is a children's book called Flowers for Sarajevo. And you should all go read it.
How about it? Anybody else? Whether you kept one or not? Oh, all right, here we go. Susan.
I'm Susan Adamchak, and like Jim, I have problems with being chronically just a few minutes late. So I made my reservation that I'm going to try to be on time for things this year, and I have succeeded. I actually made my resolution a little bit early, and I succeeded twice. I had coffee with Kathleen, and I got to the coffee shop first, and I was on time today. So keep me motivated.
Well, even though most people haven't said anything, I bet dollars to donuts that almost every one of them has made a resolution to be a better person or to take care of something that needs taken care of. And many of them will keep those resolutions for 12 months, some not quite as long. Well, off you go.
Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
Well, Michael asked me to start by remembering members of the fellowship who have died in the past year. And in thinking about that, the first thing that occurred to me is to recognize that dead means they're gone. That's the fact. But there's another fact we should remember as well, and that is the fact that they did live, in fact. Think about your own life. You dated this person instead of that person, and that means that you took this job instead of that job. That means maybe you lived here instead of there and met these people instead of those people. Each of us, our life today, is in part a reflection of the facts of the past facts. And so the message is that past facts matter, and here are some of the facts about the past of four of our members who have died in the past year. First, let me mention Sam Lacey, who died this past October. He was 98 years old, born in West Virginia, graduated from Harvard with an MD from Cornell Medical School, served in World War II, came to Topeka, I believe at Menninger's, to work there. And then in 1958 came to Manhattan to work at Pawnee Mental Health, then the North Central Kansas, Lori could tell you, Guidance Center, thank you. He's survived by his wife Yvonne of Boulder, Colorado, and one of the facts about people that's often embodied in an obituary is to which organizations you should send contributions. In Sam's case, the family suggests donations to local, national, and international organizations supporting health care for all, protection of the natural environment, alternative energy, and social justice. Those are some facts about Sam. Another member who died in the past year was Don Davis, a member here that I'm sorry to say I did not know except by sight. But let me tell you a few things about him. He arrived in Jewell County, Kansas during the big snowstorm of March 15th, 1924. He served in World War II. Later came to Smith Center, Kansas, and was a coach of the town baseball team. And when the Smith Center School Board decided that they, quote, wanted to go in a different direction for a football coach, Don was forced to find a new way to support his family. His personality was well exemplified as he told the many fans who offered to battle for his reinstatement that, quote, "If you get down in the gutter to fight, you're just in the gutter." Okay. Later, he was the first guidance counselor at Beloit High School, but that career only lasted 2 years because Don felt that the counselor's office should be a place where conversations with students were considered private rather than a source of information for the school administration. Needless to say, he lost that job. He moved to Manhattan and lived on an area called Democrat Ridge. I think I would have liked to know this man better. Next, I want to mention Phoebe Samuelson, who died in April. Some facts about her life. She earned a bachelor's degree from Bates College in Maine and then a master's degree in nursing from Yale. Her first job was as a public health nurse. That's going to resonate down the way. She was a nurse at Manhattan Junior and Senior High School for 5 years. She was an advisor to K-State students who wanted to go into nursing for many years. She started the docent program out at Kansas Prairie. Oh, sorry, this is Phoebe Samuelson. Stop me when I screw up, okay? I tell my students I'll never intentionally make a mistake, but I will make mistakes, so please. And then she was committed to women's health issues, especially the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund. The memorial contributions listed for Phoebe were to the Kansas Docent Program and the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund. The fourth member technically died in, died in not 2017, but Christmas Eve 2016. That's just a week off, so I wanted to include Jim Mitchell. I think Jim would have appreciated the fact that I could not find an obituary for Jim, nor could I find any information by the standard searches. But when I'd punch in Jim Mitchell, I got a lot of police reports. I think Jim would have enjoyed that. He was born in 1935, got a bachelor's, master's, and PhD in psychology from Ohio State University, and, as I say, died on Christmas Eve 2016. The one snippet of information I had exactly what I've just said, and then the statement that donations could be made in his name to the Southern Poverty Law Center and Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. So these are some of the past facts, the facts of the past, about Jim Mitchell, Phoebe Samuelson, Don Davis, and Sam Lacey. I want to conclude with just a few comments about one of the facts about past facts is that they influence people and the world today. So it will always be true of Sam Lacey, for example, that my own commitments to to social justice or the path I've taken in expressing those commitments is strongly influenced by the fact that as a 30-something person in Manhattan, this 50 or 60-something person was standing out at the post office passing out anti-military leaflets on tax day when people would come to the post office to pay taxes. Sam would hand them a sheet showing just how much was going to the military and the comparison of our military to all the other militaries in the world at the time in terms of expenditures. Phoebe Samuelson, memory that comes to my mind is before we had this part of the fellowship building, back at the coffee counter that's now John Alou's office, her telling me, the nurses at Manhattan High School need to be able to give out condoms. This is just a fact. I doubt that that has gone anywhere, but that was Phoebe Samuelson. Don Davis, as I say, I didn't know, and that has affected me in the following way. I'm please indulge me when I buttonhole some of you that I don't know so well and ask you about your past, because I regret not knowing more about Don Davis. And Jim Mitchell, my basic memory of Jim is him speaking up after the sermon from a visiting a minister or one of our own saying, cut the spirituality crap. And that strikes me as a good illustration of a Unitarian Universalist hymn that we have in the gray books that has the line, from wise and foolish both alike we should all strive to learn. The one can teach us how to live, the other what to spurn. And the clear articulation of opinion, I think, is certainly something to emulate. But you want to be careful in the way you express that opinion, because it can short-circuit important discussion about stuff that none of us are very sure about. So in any case, those are some of the past facts about those people, and it's time to turn the floor over to your own memories of these people and others.
Thanks. Yes, the microphone will circulate through here, and maybe if you could do 20 or 30 seconds about somebody famous or a relative or a friend or just somebody you wish you'd known who died in this past year, and just kind of you raise a hand to let Larry know. No, that's not Larry. Oh, Doug. he will bring the mic to you, and you can hold it like this, and we will hear what you have to say about your person.
Sabrina Boker, I felt kind of sad with some of the famous people that died, but who's the guy who played in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory?
Gene Wilder,
yeah. I was like, oh, no, because I found fond memories of that strange movie. But he was a good actor, but I don't know if he's done anything recent, though, but, yeah.
Kathy Hedge, I was glad that Larry mentioned being a 30-year-old something and having Sam guide you, because as I was getting ready for church this morning, I just kept thinking about all of the people that I've met here, because I started coming here when I think I was 31, or maybe 32, and just thinking about all those influences over the years of people who just kind of took me aside, sort of nudged me a little bit to be more than I thought I could be, and I very much appreciated it. And Sam was especially one of those, for those of us who taught RE, and Larry and I and Sylvia did RE for many, many decades, and he was always saying, well, no, here's, you know, I have a fish tank that I could bring over. And I still am sorry that I never did get that fish tank from Sam, but I did get many, many other things from the people that you've mentioned and the ones who were here before then.
Maybe if you held your hand up, you know, kind of every time you see Doug, that he could make this trip as efficiently as possible.
Oh, Ann Martin, and I lost my mother this summer in June 19th, the same day that my husband died, which is a strange fact, but she was 1 month shy of 103, was a great lady. She'd served in World War II overseas in the Philippines as a nurse and raised six children and just was a really forward, I mean, she was ahead of her time, put it that way, as far as rights and things like that for women, so... I just miss her almost every day. I think, oh my, you know, I'm going to tell my mother something, and she's not there, so.
Of all people, Monty Hall, the game show host whose name became identified with a puzzle problem that I used to present to my class, that both his contestants on the show and my class always got wrong. When you have three doors and you know the contents of one, should you trade for another? And the answer is inevitably, yes, you should trade. Most people don't because of a psychological phenomenon known as regret. If the door you trade for is not a winner, you regret that more than having made the trade in the first place. So, Monty Hall.
Well, the microphone is moving. My oldest sister, Jane, died this spring, just shy of her 90th birthday, and she was funny, smart, and kind. The last living person who has known me all my life.
Della Reese was mentioned on CBS Sunday Morning. But only her role in Touched by an Angel, which I was disappointed that they made no mention of her. One of my favorite voices, female voices, early, more leaning towards jazz, and then pop and with a little gospel thrown in.
Hi. I'm going to mention three, so I won't go too long on each one, but like Anne, I lost my mother as well this year, and very, very hard thing for anyone. Second one, Charles Stephen, who was a minister that visited here for 50-some years, or about 50 years, a Unitarian minister from Lincoln, and just made a big impression on our lives over the years. And always would come with a good book to discuss or something. And nobody did that better than Charles. And then I would like to mention Mary Tyler Moore, because I grew up in a real traditional household, and Mary Tyler Moore, sort of an idea of what a woman could be working out in the world. And you could start to think about envisioning yourself with colleagues, and I don't know, it's just opened up another view of something.
I lost two cousins this year. One was my oldest cousin. She was the firstborn grandchild of my grandparents. And then a cousin who was a year younger than me, who had been a paraplegic since he was 7 years old. I was amazed that he lasted as long as he did. He outlived the doctors by 50-some years. Because when he went in, he had a hole in his heart, and he went in for surgery, and he came out paralyzed more or less from the mid-stomach down. And so that you know, but he was able to survive all those years. The other thing, this has been a really bad year for musicians. You know, Fats Domino, Della Reese, I mean, the list is pretty long when we think of the musicians of a certain generation, shall we say, who have passed beyond. And I think that's going to affect how we see music. Anyway, it's affected me because I went out and bought some things I probably shouldn't have bought just to listen to those songs one last time.
Ann Cowan, in reading the Mercury this morning, I was reminded of the deaths at Fort Riley this year, which really I find very upsetting. There were 12 deaths. I believe 11 of them will turn out to be suicides. And I just wonder what we are doing to address that in any way. And I know everyone keeps trying, but it just goes on and on.
Now, speaking of musicians, Donna Summer was also a good, she died this year, if I remember correctly, and I always loved Donna. She's just the sweetest thing in the world. Thank you.
Well, these and others we can keep in our minds as we move through the morning. while the baskets make their way through the congregation, we will be listening to the Pia Jesu from John Rutter's Requiem. This is from a mass that may be one of the best known in the country. And it often has been played or sung at memorials for 9/11. And it just happens that one movement, Sanctus, was played at the funeral of Helmut Kohl, among lots of other good stuff was played there. So it's Pia Jesu, Dona Eis Requiem, Blessed Lord Jesus, give them rest, and then give them eternal rest, Aeternum Requiem, and then Sempiternum Requiem, which is really long rest. Five of us are going to talk about some people who died this year. Doug Walter leads off, and it says Nat Hentoff, but he has changed to John Portman Jr., whose name may not be quite as familiar, but Doug?
Michael asked me to participate in this about a month ago, and I was preparing to respond and say, nah. but I thought before I would do that, I would take a quick look at notable deaths of 2017, and that's when I noted Nat Hentoff, who died on January 7th. I knew him, sort of, from the pages of Sojourners magazine back in the 1980s. And I learned then that he was an atheist who ardently opposed abortion. And so I thought, well, this would be interesting to revisit and try to learn some more about that. And I was still struggling last night trying to make it work. And death popped up on the New York Times at 3 o'clock, and I said, this is for me. So, John Portman Jr. died Friday in Atlanta. So I don't know if we have any award categories for our presentations today, but if so, I think I get the one for the most recent death. He was 93. The Times characterized Portman as an architect and developer who revolutionized hotel designs. He built commercial towers that revitalized decaying downtowns and transformed Asian skylines. I was a student of architecture here at K-State when Mr. Portman was just coming into prominence. Now, I recall studying I.M. Pei, designed the Hancock Tower in Boston, Philip Johnson, among many other projects, the Glass House in New Canaan, Connecticut. It really is a completely glass house. And even Minoru Yamasaki. Anybody know what he designed? The original World Trade Center. So I remember studying lots of people, but not Mr. Portman. Could very well have, I don't remember. So I thought I should do a little bit of research beyond the Times obituary and Wikipedia. Interestingly, Wikipedia had already been updated yesterday to reflect his death. I don't know how that happens, but so I went to my library. I grabbed my 1600-page A History of Architecture by Sir Banister Fletcher. It's a classic text for the study of architectural history. And mine's been updated to the 20th, include 20th century architects. It had many of the architects I've mentioned, but not Mr. Portman. So what influence did John Portman have on architecture you may have experienced? If you stayed at a hotel with a central atrium, it was either designed by him or influenced by his many successful hotel designs. The 22-story Hyatt Regency Atlanta, which was completed in 1967, was the first of Portman's atrium hotels. It instantly became one of the most recognized buildings in Atlanta. It influenced hotel design for years. That hotel featured a revolving restaurant on its top, the first of many to come. How many of you have had a meal in a revolving restaurant? Yeah. Portman's atrium hotels also featured glass elevators on open shafts in the atriums. Regarding his glass elevators, Portman had this to say: "Everyone talks on a glass elevator. You get on a closed-in elevator, everyone looks down at their shoes. A glass elevator lets people's spirits expand." Aren't architects great? I was somewhat surprised that the Times obituary included a paragraph about the Hyatt Regency, Kansas City. It was an atrium hotel inspired by, but not designed by, Portman. I think many of us here in the room recall the horrendous structural failure there in 1981 during a tea dance, resulted in 114 deaths and 216 injuries. The Times mentioned that as a setback for the atrium concept in hotel design. And I'm going to disagree with that. It was that structural failure was a very specific design, actually an engineering detail. Got to get that in there. Portman defied the architectural ethic of his time by becoming a real estate developer. Having no money to start with, he made and lost millions co-financing many of his own projects. His signature development was the Peachtree Center in downtown Atlanta. It was developed between 1965 and 1989, but it came under criticism for turning its back on Atlanta's downtown street life. And the reason it drew that criticism because of the elevated skywalks, elevated and enclosed. At 86, when the Times last interviewed Portman, he was still running John Portman and Associates. "A fish got to swim and a bird got to fly," he told the Times in a Southern comfort drawl. "I'm here 6 days a week, and it'd be seven if I didn't make a commitment to my wife to take a day off." He never retired.
Susan Adams had to kick it, but I don't know.
glass elevators give me the heebie-jeebies. I'm going to speak today about Norma Leah Nelson McCorvey. Born in 1947, she died early this year, 2017. Norma McCorvey was an unlikely heroine. In fact, she later renounced the very cause she championed. Nevertheless, Norma McCorvey's actions changed the lives of millions of women by taking a stand for reproductive rights, and it can be argued she changed the course of American politics for nearly five decades. Her name probably doesn't ring a bell for many of you, but I suspect that you are aware of her as Jane Roe, the plaintiff in Roe v. Wade, the landmark case decided by the Supreme Court 45 years ago this coming January. Norma had a rough childhood. She was born in Simsport, Louisiana, on September 22, 1947, and later the family moved to Houston. Her father was frequently gone for long periods, and left the family when she was 13. She and her brother were raised by her mother, who was a violent alcoholic. She spent time at the State School for Girls in Gainesville off and on from age 11 to 15. One source said this. She remarked that that was the happiest time of her life. Norma married at 16, but subsequently left her abusive husband when pregnant with her daughter, who was later adopted by Norma's mother. At 19, she had her second child, who was adopted by a waiting couple. In September 1969, the month she turned 22, Norma became pregnant with her third child. She told her doctor that she did not want to bring that pregnancy to term, but she could not afford to travel to any of the six states where abortion was then legal. And just to give you an idea, that among the six were Hawaii, Alaska, New York, Washington State. Not exactly easy places for a poor, destitute woman from Texas to get to. The physician referred her to an adoption lawyer. He, in turn, referred her to Linda Coffey and Sarah Weddington, knowing that they were seeking a pregnant woman to serve as a plaintiff in a case challenging Texas statutes. Norma was hopeful that Coffey and Weddington would find success in time for her to have a legal abortion. Instead, the case took 3 years, multiple trials, appeals, and eventually it reached the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Norma gave birth to a baby who was given up for adoption and never attended any of the trials. She revealed herself as Jane Roe soon after the decision's issuance and stated that she sought an abortion because she was unemployable and depressed. She also later claimed that she had been a pawn of the two young attorneys, Coffey and Weddington, who brought the case. Yet, not long after Roe was decided, she began volunteering at an abortion clinic and continued to do so for some years. In 1995, Norma met Flip Benham, who was then the national director of Operation Rescue and an evangelical minister. Operation Rescue had opened an office directly across the street from the Dallas clinic where she was working at that time. Several months later, she was baptized as a member of his congregation. Not only did she undergo this religious conversion, but this was a career change. She went from championing abortion rights to fighting against the very decision that she had helped institute. She created the Roe No More Ministry, which for several years which was a nonprofit organization, and for several years it generated financial security for Norma and her longtime partner, Connie Gonzalez. But this didn't last long. By the early 2000s, she was again living on food stamps and seeking financial assistance. She abandoned Gonzalez, her partner of 35 years, who had suffered a stroke. To quote her obituary in the Washington Post, Ms. McCorvey was a complicated protagonist in a legal case that became a touchstone in the culture wars, celebrated by champions as an affirmation of women's freedom, and denounced by opponents as the nationwide legalization of murder of the unborn. There was a retrospective published just last week in Politico, which summarized the cultural impact of the Roe ruling as it galvanized those opposed to it. They turned to politics, campaigning for human life amendments to kill Roe at its legal root. When legislative efforts failed, they turned to the judiciary, seeking the appointment of like-minded judges. Opposition to abortion turned political and then partisan. The National Right to Life Committee declared the GOP the party of life. Politicians conformed. Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan turned pro-life. Ted Kennedy and Al Gore, pro-choice. Religion fell in line, too. Whereas in 1976, the Southern Baptist Convention supported most abortions, it opposed most by 1980. Abortion fast became this country's surest test of political affiliation. The same article concludes that McCorvey befit Roe v. Wade as no other could. Like the nation at large, she pledged her allegiance both to its survival and its destruction.
Going through lists of this past year, I found 13 obituaries of economists. Their average age was 89 when they died, and only two of them were younger than I am, so this gives me some hope. I want to share some comments about a few of them, concluding with even more about remarks about Anthony Atkinson. I think there would be general consensus within the discipline that Nobel Prize winner Kenneth Arrow's contributions to the understanding of a wide variety of economic phenomena ranks him very near the top of 20th century economists. Some of his work was more than a little above my pay grade, but his very sophisticated analysis of the benefits of competition, well known since Adam Smith's time, stood up very well to whatever tests he could devise. what he also did was to demonstrate that there were some costs to competition and benefits to people not involved in the transactions. These impacts came to be known as external costs and external benefits, and he said they deserved attention by makers of public policy right alongside the benefits of increased competition. William Baumol did not discover the widely accepted notion that a rising tide raises all boats. What he did do was to find imaginative ways to quantify what had been something of a mystery to economists. Here's an example of the key issue. We know that today's most gifted musicians were surely not a whole lot better at performing a Beethoven string quartet than their predecessors, but they were earning a lot more than the best musicians of 1817. This suggests that the readily measurable gains in worker productivity spilled over into the income gains of those whose productivity had not improved much. There were two women in the mix, neither of whom was familiar to me. Dorothy Rice, lacking a graduate degree in economics, understood public economics better than many economists with years of studying and teaching the subject. As an analyst at the Social Security Administration, her research and analysis of the medical needs matched by inadequate resources for poor and elderly Americans did more than any other person to fashion the mechanics of Medicare and Medicaid. Vera Schlachman was born in 1909, 108 years ago. She was one of the very few women of her era to earn a PhD in economics. She is best known among economic historians for her path-breaking study published in 1935 of female factory workers in 19th century Massachusetts. It's called The Economic History of a Factory Town. In 1952, she refused to tell Senator Joseph McCarthy and the Senate Internal Security Committee whether she had ever been a member of the Communist Party. As a result, she was fired from her professorship at Queens College, part of the New York City public university system. She never taught economics again, working sometimes as an accountant and ultimately in a series of faculty appointments in social work departments. Lester Thoreau may be the best-known economist in this era to people outside the discipline. For years, he was a regular guest on television shows and frequent author of short magazine and newspaper articles. Many academic economists were somewhat dismissive of his policy recommendations, which, to many of them, seemed to rely on premises too thin to support grand conclusions. It may also be the case that the $30,000 speaker's fees that he regularly earned, which would be double that amount in today's dollars, reflected only professional envy. Of particularly influential economists who died, other particularly influential economists who died this year include the following: William Goldman, who probably knew more about the Soviet and later the Russian economy than anyone else on the planet; Thomas Schelling, a Nobel laureate who masterminded U.S. policy on nuclear strategy; Uwe Reinhardt, who is regarded by economists and politicians alike as the country's most knowledgeable student of medical economics; Alan Meltzer, who doggedly shadowed the Federal Reserve, delighting its critics and sending its defenders like me into fits of apoplexy; Charles Schultz, whose years of practical application of economic theory in government service earned the respect of his peers and election to the presidency of the American Economics Association; David Dowd, who used his compensation for teaching economics to support his tireless efforts as an anti-war activist. I close with what is to me my greatest loss, the way too early death of Anthony Atkinson at the age of 72. Atkinson was one of the half dozen or so of the world's most highly regarded scholars trying to make sense of rising economic inequality in the U.S. and most of the rest of the world's wealthy countries, and to provide guidance to all of us about the policies most likely to be successful in reversing this trend. His recommendations did not find their way into the tax policy changes just approved by the U.S. Congress. Instead of much higher marginal income tax rates for those most able to pay their fair share, we got lower rates for the richest members of our society. Rather than significant increases in estate taxes, ours were phased out. Because of his passing, arguably the most cogent possible critic of this travesty was unavailable to speak. His voice will be missed, but his readily accessible research and insightful writing will provide excellent guidance to all who want to join the efforts towards a more just sharing of the benefits of our country's economy and resources, income and resources. Heidrich Bohl.
I will be speaking about Helmut Kohl, German Chancellor from 1982 to 1998. My remarks are based on an article to which Berlin-based AP correspondents Frank Jordan and David Rising contributed shortly after Kohl's death on June 17th at the age of 87. Over his 16 years as German Chancellor, Kohl combined a tireless pursuit of European unity with a keen instinct for history. Less than a year after the November 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall, he spearheaded the end of Germany's 44-year-long division into East and West, ushering in a new era in European politics. Whoa, I went a little too far, sorry. After his death, Chancellor Angela Merkel said, when a new spirit began to sweep through Eastern Europe in the 1980s, notably Poland, when brave people in Leipzig, East Berlin, and elsewhere in East Germany staged a peaceful revolution, Helmut Kohl was the right person at the right time, end quote. It was the close friendships that Kohl established with other world leaders that helped him persuade both anti-communist Western allies and the leaders of the collapsing Soviet Union that a strong, united Germany could live at peace with its neighbors. Kohl moved nimbly in domestic politics and among rivals in his conservative CDU until his defeat by left rival Gerhard Schröder in 1998. For foreigners, Kohl symbolized a benign, steady, even dull Germany. Kohl's legacy includes the heavy lobbying for a common euro currency now used by 19 nations that bound Europe more closely together than ever before. Kohl combined an understanding of the worries of ordinary Germans with a hunger for power, getting elected four times. Voters do not like Kohl, but they trust him, a former Speaker of Parliament once said. Often harsh and thin-skinned, Kohl also could display a quick wit and jovial earthiness. He ate pasta with Bill Clinton and took saunas with Russian Boris Yeltsin. Kohl linked his dedication to a united Europe to his roots in a part of Germany close to France and his memories of a wartime boyhood. The blooming landscapes that Kohl promised East Germany, there we went again a little too far, the blooming landscape that Kohl promised East German voters during unification were slow to come after the collapse of its communist economy and massive aid to the East pushed up government debt. He drew criticism for failing to embark on economic reforms. Born on April 3, 1930, in Ludwigshafen, a Western industrial city on the Rhine, Kohl was part of the Hitler Youth. As a 15-year-old, he was about to be called into service in a German anti-aircraft gun unit when World War II ended. His oldest brother, Walter, was killed in action a few months earlier. A Roman Catholic, Kohl joined the CDU in his teens shortly after its post-war founding. He earned his doctorate in 1958 at the University of Heidelberg with a dissertation on the politics of Rhineland-Pfalz and became governor of that state in 1969. His first attempt to unseat Social Democratic Chancellor Helmut Schmidt failed in 1976, but Kohl seized his chance 6 years later, taking power on October 1, 1982, when a junior coalition party switched sides. Kohl was reluctant to view United Germany as a major power. Still, he slowly edged his country toward greater responsibilities in the 1990s as Germany sent troops for UN humanitarian missions into Cambodia, Somalia, and elsewhere, and deployed peacekeepers to Bosnia. Kohl was helped in securing German unity by his friendships with French President François Mitterrand and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Who approved NATO membership for a united Germany and agreed to pull Soviet troops out of East Germany. Kohl's earlier bridge building with the United States also paid off. The stationing of U.S. Pershing II missiles starting in 1983, despite huge domestic protests, had established trust in Washington that was crucial to creating a single German state. It was a stroke of luck that there were four or six leaders in power in the mid-80s, who really trusted one another and could really make things happen, Kohl recalled later. In his memoirs, he described George H.W. Bush as the most important ally on the road to German unity. He praised former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher for her honesty, even as he recalled a confrontation with her just days after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Elation over German reunification ebbed amid the harsh realities of its cost and the difficulties of integrating East and West, but Kohl's coalition won again in 1994. Yet high unemployment and Germans' yearning for change gradually diminished his authority, provoking a humiliating loss to Gerhard Schröder in 1998. The following year, Kohl plunged his party into crisis when he admitted accepting undeclared and therefore illegal donations during his time as chancellor. Kohl refused to identify the donors. When prosecutors launched an investigation into possible breach of trust charges, Kohl was pressured to give up his party's symbolic honorary chairmanship. The probe later was dropped in exchange for about $140,000 fine, giving Kohl the legal stamp of innocence. Kohl also fought and won a legal fight to prevent the release of the files held on him by East Germany's secret police. Kohl's estrangement from his party lasted until 2002, when its new leaders invited him to speak at a convention. Kohl was married for 41 years to Hannelore Renner, an interpreter of English and French, who stood firmly but discreetly by his side. They had two sons, Peter and Walter. In July 2001, Hannelore committed suicide at age 68 in despair over an incurable allergy to light. In 2005, Kohl introduced his new partner, Maike Richter, 35 years his junior. The couple married in 2008. Kohl became estranged from his sons due to his marriage. The family feud came to a climax after Kohl's death when the disagreement about Kohl's funeral and burial site was fought out in front of the German and European public. So slowed by illness, Kohl still made occasional headlines as Merkel struggled to convince center-right lawmakers of having Germany finance further bailouts of other Eurozone nations. Kohl weighed in firmly. There must be no question for us that we in the European Union and the Eurozone stand by Greece in solidarity, he declared. He questioned Merkel's decision to speed up Germany's exit from nuclear energy and Germany's abstention in a UN vote on a no-fly zone over Libya. When Syrian and other refugees started flooding in, he stated that Europe could not become the new home for millions of people in need worldwide. Despite their differences, Merkel made clear that Kohl had touched her life deeply when he helped forge reunification. Like millions of others, I was able to go from a life under a dictatorship to a life of freedom, she said. He will continue to live in our memories as a great European and as the Chancellor of Reunification. Thank you.
I'm going to speak about Dick Gregory. Wasn't that right? Oh, boy. I hope I don't go too long. So I'm going to talk about Dick Gregory, who was an African-American stand-up comedian who died August 19th at the age of 84. And I think of Dick Gregory as a stand-up comic, but Gregory's life is known for his contributions to the American civil rights movement and African-American culture in general. Now, Gregory's comedic flair ran throughout his political activism, and most will agree that his perspective and impacts on important social issues were enhanced by his sharp comic wit. He drew on current events, like the case of Rosa Parks, where she would not move to the back of the bus where it was segregated for Negroes, to illuminate racial issues in much of his stand-up comedy. Segregation is not all that bad, he said. Have you ever heard of a traffic collision where the people in the back of the bus got hurt? Gregory broke out as part of a new generation of black comedians that included the likes of Nipsey Russell, Bill Cosby, and Godfrey Chambridge, all of whom separated their acts from those at blacks-only clubs and were better integrated with white audiences. Now, in 1961, Gregory was working at the Robert Show Bar in Chicago. He started off, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I understand there are a good many Southerners in the room tonight. I know the South very well. I spent 20 years there one night." He went on with his act. He said, "Last time I was down South, I walked into this restaurant, and this white waitress came up to me and said, 'We don't serve colored people here.' And I said, 'That's all right. I don't eat colored people. Now bring me a whole fried chicken.' Then," he said, "these three white boys came up to me and said, 'Boy, we're giving you fair warning. Anything you do to that chicken, we're going to do to you.' So I put down my knife and fork, I picked up that chicken, and I kissed it." "Then I said, 'Line up, boys.'" Well, it turns out that sitting in that largely white audience that night was Hugh Hefner, who then hired Gregory to work at a Chicago Playboy Club. Everybody know who Hugh Hefner was? In fact, he died in 2017. So there's a whole other topic, but I won't go into that right now. In any case, his relationship with Hefner was a critical catapult for Dick Gregory's career. Humor became the medium by which Gregory was able to get his listeners to feel comfortable thinking about racism in the U.S. and the need for action on civil rights, such as, "You know the definition of a Southern moderate? That's a cat that'll lynch you from a low tree." Anyway, early in his comedy career, Gregory was invited to be on The Tonight Show starring Jack Parr. Now, that's before Johnny Carson had the really long run on the Tonight Show. At that time, black comics were known to perform on the show, but they never. But after their stand-up routines, they were not allowed to stay and sit on the couch and talk with the host. Dick Gregory declined several invitations from Jack Parr to perform, and Parr finally called him on the phone to find out why he refused. And Gregory told him he wanted some time on the couch. The producers eventually agreed to allow him to stay after his performance and talk with the host on air. And this was the first for a black entertainer in that show's history or any mainstream television show to do that. Gregory had made many other TV appearances after that and became a national success. It was Dick Gregory's conviction that within a well-delivered joke lies power. They were going to laugh anyway, but if I made the jokes, they'd laugh with me instead of at me, he said in his 1964 autobiography. After a while, he wrote, I could say anything I wanted. I got a reputation as a funny man, and then I started to turn the jokes on them. His autobiography was titled Nigger, lowercase n. That word, typically referred to these days as the N-word, figured prominently in his routines. Even as he shunned the obscenities and profanities that casually littered the acts of other comedians like Lenny Bruce. Increasingly, he skipped his club dates to march or perform at benefits for civil rights groups. Club owners became reluctant to book him. Who knew if he might fly off to Alabama on a moment's notice? In 1967, Dick Gregory ran for the mayor of Chicago against Richard Daley, more or less as a stunt. The next year, he ran for president on the Freedom and Peace Party ticket. He estimated that he got 1.5 million write-in votes, but the official figure was just over 47,000 votes. Hey, just the same, he got significant press coverage. There seemed few causes he would not embrace. He took to fasting for weeks on end, his once robust body shrinking at times to 95 pounds. Across the decades, he went on dozens of hunger strikes and sit-ins over issues including the Vietnam War, the failed Equal Rights Amendment, police brutality, South African apartheid, nuclear power, the 1980s U.S. embassy crisis in Iran, prison reform, drug abuse, and American Indian rights. Even after Gregory stopped performing in comedy clubs in the mid-70s, he often worked hundreds of speaking invitations a year at colleges and churches. His son, Christian Gregory, one of his 11 children, said that these appearances were billed like lectures, but were entertainment. He would grab and read anything he could get his hands on. That was his research for a lecture. Information was slippery, and it needed moral framing, but you could get ideas to people through comedy, his son said. Lastly, in an interview with Gentleman's Quarterly a few years ago, Gregory was asked, could we conclude that, to some degree at least, the civil rights movement failed? Failed? God knows, says Gregory. Who would ever have believed the president of the United States could be a black man? Never before in the history of this planet has anyone made the progress in a 50-year period that African Americans have achieved in America. Any regrets then? Asked the reporter. Anything else you'd like to have done? I have no regrets. I am a soldier, and my life has been a soldier's life. I feel I'm coming to the end of the war, but I'm still scouring the bushes, convinced that there's got to be one or two more of the enemy left to chase. And yes, there is something else I wish I had done. You know what it is? He paused and laughed his rich, sonorous voice. More.
I think we'll forego the circle. It won't be broken. If we do, and you can listen to it in all sorts of places on YouTube. I want to close with words from Anna Friedman Glauber, who was a tireless advocate for women of every faith, race, or occupation. She died earlier this year. The cause was pancreatic cancer. Here are 9 lessons from her 2014 book, Advice for a Happy Life, Lessons from My Mother. Be disciplined about the positive and practice it. Be in the present and use it to move forward. Be a listener and limit what you say about yourself. Be at your best at all times and don't be a perfectionist. Be proud of your religion and respect all religions. Be funny. Do not laugh at jokes that undermine you. Be connected to nature and stay connected. Be a giver and set limits. Be involved in something larger than yourself and stay involved. As she grappled with her diagnosis, she remembered another of her mother's favorite sayings. Yesterday is a memory. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. That is why it's called the present. Amen. Thank you. Thanks to all the presenters, too. They're nice words. And don't forget, coffee has been made. It'll warm you up before you hit the road.